I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com. I got to know today's guest, Don Matez, through our mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Pam Popper of Wellness Forum Health. Pam had recommended Don's book, Powered by Plants, and I did want to get around to reading it, but I kind of flatter myself that I would know what was in it. I've co-written three books on plant-based nutrition. I've read pretty much all of them. I've looked at thousands of research studies, and I didn't think there'd be that much new in it. It would maybe be a new twist, and of course, everyone's got their own unique voice, and Don has a great backstory from having gone from vegetarian to being seduced by paleo for a while, and then recovering and writing this book partly in response to what he saw as his own logical failings in accepting some fallacies of the paleo movement. So I thought that'd all be interesting. What I didn't count on was how much new stuff there would be in this book for me. And we'll get into a lot of that in the interview. But one of the first things I admit to Don is that I didn't finish the book by the time the interview started. It's because I couldn't. It's because I couldn't skim it the way I'm used to skimming books on a topic that I know a lot about. There is so much richness in here, so much to ponder, so many things I wanted to follow up, look through the bibliography, and know more about myself. This really is a masterpiece of investigative journalism, of putting together a big picture, much bigger than just plants are good for you, much bigger than the politics of food marketing. It really is a tremendous work. And so it is with great pleasure that I present to you this interview. So without further ado, Don Matez, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so I'm working my way through your fantastic book, Powered by Plants, and I have to admit I have not finished it yet, which is it's rare for me to admit, and it's also rare for me to not finish it. I gave myself what I thought was plenty of time, but there is a lot of stuff in here. This is a very, very, shall we say, fact and evidence dense piece of writing. The amount of research you put into this has been remarkable. And first of all, I want to thank you for the work and commit to finishing it, because the parts I've read so far have been just amazing.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, it took me a long time. I don't remember how long. And truly, there is a lot of research behind it. It's the culmination of research that actually started before I recommitted to a plant-based diet during my, what I call my paleo days, spelled D-A-Z-E. and then, just went from there.
Well, let's talk about that, because you said you're recommitting to a plant-based diet. So I'm guessing you were vegetarian at some point, and then you were convinced to try paleo. So kind of,
That's correct.
Tell us your, before we get into the the evidence. Tell us your own journey.
When I was about 20 years of age, I adopted a lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet. And there was a period of time leading up to that where I was eating more and more plant-based and believed that aside for the moment. So I spent, during my college years, I started as a pre-med major, but I ended up being a philosophy major. And my specialty was Asian philosophy, and I became essentially became a Buddhist. And and of course that led me to think about the ethics of what I was eating. And that was a major reason that I adopted a lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet at that time. At the same time, I was into athletics, athletic performance, and I had read the sports medicine book by Gabe Merkin, and he was recommending, as were most sports nutritionists then, as now, recommending a predominantly plant-based diet, high in carbohydrate, to improve your athletic performance. So those two things dovetailed, and I said, well, why not? I mean, the two things come together, so we'll just go on that path. So I then, because of my interest in Asian philosophy, I kind of gravitated towards the macrobiotic style of plant-based eating. And for about 12 or so years, I was varying degrees of plant-based, sometimes vegan, sometimes more lacto-ovo-vegetarian, sometimes more like pesco-vegetarian, meaning small amounts of fish now and then. the largest portion of that time was mostly vegan. And then with more details are in the book, but my first wife, who was trained as a macrobiotic cook, and I got exposed to the paleo diet arguments through a book called Neanderthin. I don't know if you've heard of that, by Ray Audette. And it gave a very interesting argument. It was basically a huge naturalistic fallacy, but I kind of fell for it given my circumstances and state of mind at the time. And so I decided to go paleo for what I thought were sort of evolution-based scientific reasons, as well as some, I was, I made a number of mistakes when eating plant-based vegan at that time. I wasn't knowledgeable enough. The biggest mistake was not taking a vitamin B12 supplement on a regular basis. So I wasn't getting the maximum possible benefits from a plant-based diet. And
so what were the key arguments in I have in my notes here to ask you, like, what attracted you to paleo? Was it principally the arguments that seemed airtight, even though it was a naturalistic fallacy as you see it now? Was it more an emotional appeal, or was it like a story? Because I think, you know, it's extremely important, as you've written a book now, to kind of talk about the paleo movement, to understand where all the energy is coming from.
I think that, as you said, you didn't finish the book yet. So when you get to the last chapter, the first introduction in the last chapter, I kind of covered that directly or indirectly. So I think part of it is what I explained in the first chapter of, or introduction to the book, is that most of us live in what is now called, by Melanie Joy's appellation, a carnistic society. So we believe that eating meat or some type of animal product is normal, natural, and necessary. And so our tendency is, if anything goes wrong with someone who, because we're taught this from a very early age, I mean, people are saying, if you don't finish your chicken, you're not going to grow up to be big and strong or whatever, you know. Our parents and our whole society pass along that whole deeply embedded belief system. So when we grow up and we become adults and we become rationally convinced, perhaps, that a plant-based diet is best for us, we still have this deep emotional attachment to eating animal products that started from an early age because of this kind of indoctrination that we get from our entire society. So as soon as we see something go wrong, like, I don't think my nails are growing as fast, or I'm getting colds more frequently, which is something that happened to me when I was living in a northern climate and I wasn't getting adequate sunshine. I was living in Seattle, and I wasn't even aware that I was missing vitamin D. I wasn't thinking about that and that I should be getting that from the sun, but the climate itself was prohibiting that, and I wasn't taking a supplement. So I started, the first thing the mind, at least my mind, came up with was, this is because I'm not eating meat. That's what my mom would say. That's what many doctors would say, blah, blah, blah. So if you start to search for solutions to your problem, because especially in the 80s, there weren't a lot of people who were experienced at eating plant-based diet and there was, in some cases, some just generally lacking knowledge. we tend to run into people who present a solution which is not plant-based, and they point to your plant-based diet as the reason, and it reinforces this emotional commitment, and then embedded belief system you have that has emotional content. Excuse me, I got a little something caught in my throat. And then we also have this, as I discussed in the last chapter of the book, we have this science, or at least in anthropology, I discuss how if you look at all the ways that people have looked at evolution, they all, according to one author, I cite a paper, a person who's an anthropologist and a specialist in literature, noticed that every single account of human evolution fits the mythic hero journey. So we look at the past, and it's all about this initially inept, underpowered individual who's kind of stuck in a certain place, which for humans was the trees, supposedly. And then through some type of some special experience, he or she becomes aware of greater possibilities, and that would be the savanna. And then some gift from the gods or from a enlightened master is given, which in the story of evolution is our intelligence or tools or something, gives us that ability to take on this greater challenge. And then we go through a series of challenges, which in the story of evolution is the ice ages and dealing with all the beasts and so forth and all of that. And then you become the hero and you bring home, literally, the bison and save the damsel, which is, you know, the family, by doing this great deed. And then you run into the hero's paradox, of course, which is that now you have all these great abilities, but the abilities end up turning against you. So now you have this great civilization, and now you're poisoning the environment and blah, blah, blah. So it all fits. Now you have to deal with this challenge of the gifts that were given to you are now turning against you. That's also part of the mythic hero's journey. So anthropology in particular is, because of its very sparse evidence for human evolutionary changes, it's very prone to creative imagination about what happened.
So this sounds like they're Joseph Campbell versus T. Colin Campbell.
Yeah. In a way, that's right. Well, at least in my case, and I think this is true of many people, I've watched people who say who are plant-based and then said that it wasn't working for them and all of that. And I've watched these things over time, over years, in particular since I have resumed eating a vegan diet. And I noticed that there is the same kind of process going on. It's very deeply psychological. And I don't mean that that people are mentally ill or something. It's just this way we are conditioned by our society to accept a certain lifestyle as normal, natural, and necessary. And it's very hard to break out of that tribal belief.
So you fell for this naturalistic fallacy. You went paleo. Why aren't you still paleo?
Yeah, well, not paleo because it didn't do me well. So there's two strains that answer that question. So one is, while I'm paleo, I'm a very inquisitive person. I'm studious. I like to understand what I'm doing. So, and I have this background in philosophy. So, of course, I'm paleo, and I'm just, I got the word from the paleo diet book. It's all good, and so on. I check up on the references. You know, I adopt it because it sounds good, but then I want to know for sure that I'm doing, that it all fits together as presented. So when I start checking up the references, hey, it doesn't all fit together so greatly. A lot of these things stated as facts are really assumptions or hypotheses and so forth. So there's that intellectual inquiry going on while I'm eating paleo. And meanwhile, the diet is affecting my health. So I start to get increased eczema outbreaks, and I start to have a resurgence of sinus problems that I had gotten rid of when I was eating a vegan diet. And I start to have prostatitis symptoms in my late 40s. And when I go and get my cholesterol tested, it's 235. And my LDL is high. And it's all like not, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance on, because I'm supposed to be on the healthiest diet for humans that's possible. And yet, these numbers aren't saying that, my symptoms aren't saying that. And then also, as I'm inquiring deeper and deeper into the intellectual foundations of this belief system, I'm starting to come up with flaws in logic and assumptions. So finally, the straw that got me to completely change, I'd been in a state of kind of doubt and questioning, which was kind of recorded in my blog for, I would say it was about a year. I had, during that time, met my current wife, and she started eating paleo with me. And after about a year, she gained about 20 pounds. To make the story a little bit shorter, she got very bad fibrocystic breast changes. There were other things as well, but that was the most alarming thing. And it reminded me, when it happened, of, I had seen it in my former wife as well, when we went from eating plant-based to eating more. When we adopted paleo, after a period of time, she started to have those fibrocystic breast changes. And incidentally, she ended up going on to have breast cancer and recently passed away. So I knew that fibrocystic breast changes are a risk factor for breast cancer. And I saw it happening in my new wife. And I don't want her to go through the same thing that I saw my former wife goes through and suddenly like a whole bunch of pieces of puzzle kind of fit together in my mind. And I said, we're going plant-based. And it was pretty much like that. We just kind of, within about 2 months, we were completely plant-based.
And then what happened in terms of your own experience?
Well, my cholesterol went down 50 points. Tracy's breast issue completely healed in a month or 3 months. Totally healed in 3 months. She's sitting here. And then she dropped 20 pounds and, you know, our health improved dramatically. I haven't had a sign of prostatitis since going plant-based again. So I'm completely happy with the results. And now I'm more informed and have a better evidence base and also know what mistakes I made in the past. So I now feel better than I have, you know, in all my life, basically.
So in your book, Powered by Plants, which is basically kind of looking at the whole paleo argument, I think if there had been no paleo movement, you might not have written the book. But, you know, you're looking at, you know, the basic argument is this is how our ancestors ate before we got all sissified by civilization.
Correct.
Right. So,
yeah.
So what's wrong with that argument? It has, you know, for me, for like a guy, you know, it has a lot of appeal. I remember, you know, my dad like doing cookouts on the 4th of July and on Father's Day and like grilling the meat. And, you know, it told a story of manhood that I wanted to achieve. And, you know, there's the whole, you know, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. Like I'm being oppressed by this civilization and I just want to find my inner, you know, manhood and be natural. What's wrong with that narrative?
Well, I would first say that's exactly part of what, you know, draws males in particular to paleo. And I have to say that was part of the package that's put in front of everyone, and that's part of what attracted me to paleo too, is there's this whole masculinity thing hooked up with the idea of eating meat and hunting and all of that as well. So there's that great story, but that connects back to what I was saying earlier. But I, you know, as I say in the book, there's one major problem with this is that it's simply what we call a red herring in philosophy. It's simply here's what we're trying to do is figure out what the ideal optimum diet for humans, well, for modern humans, the ones who are walking around on the planet right now. So where better to study that than among modern humans? And then suddenly somebody comes, wait a minute, no, we should look at what people ate 500,000 years ago. And because then they maybe trail along what you kind of said, because now we're all sissified and, you know, this isn't really the way we're supposed to eat, or it's not our natural state. There's the naturalistic fallacy thing, you know, what's natural is best. So let's look at that. Well, that's like, it's just a distraction because if you want to find out what's best for modern humans, you should just study modern humans. You don't need to know what people 500,000 years ago did, because these people are right in front of you. In other words, we don't try to figure out what's the best diet for rats in the laboratory by trying to find out what rats ate 500,000 years ago. We just study rats and we take modern rats and we feed them different foods and find out what makes them healthier. That's all you need to do. So it's just a total distraction. That's number one. That's the biggest thing. It's distracting us from readily available evidence that's, you know, replicated in hundreds or thousands of studies on modern humans. Instead, we're gonna go from there to a lot of speculations about what people ate 500,000 years ago, because, you know, they didn't leave videos, they didn't leave diet records, they you know, didn't take photos and post them on Facebook of what they were eating. We don't have any idea accept from little bits and pieces of evidence, which is it's selective because organic matter decays over time in some environments more quickly than others. And so everything, all the bits of evidence we have from the past of what humans ate is greatly biased by the way evidence is preserved in the fossil record. So, for example, bones, yeah, they last a fairly long time because they're mineral, but, you know, stems or husks from corn, which this is an example, they're not going to last. We're not going to have a garbage pile of corn husks from 500,000 years ago if, you know, such a thing had existed, because it just decays within 50 or 100 days, and it's gone.
All right, that's like looking through your garbage from a year ago and discovering that all you had was, like, you know, Bud Light and,
yeah, right,
and McDonald's takeout.
Yeah, right, exactly, because that's what survived. So those are the two main problems, I think, is that the fossil record is highly biased, and the whole direction is just a distraction from a more reliable source of evidence, our, you know, current human population.
Right. Now, you lay things out in pretty stark terms, and I really enjoyed the dichotomies that you created between plants and animals and between plant eaters and flesh eaters. And,
yes,
and you say very starkly that this is the hypothesis here. We have to choose one. We're either supposed to be eating a lot of starch or a lot of animal flesh. You know, that we're either supposed to be eating sweets or meats. And so, first of all, where what's the basis for making that distinction, that line in the sand, as opposed to, you know, a lot of people talk about, well, some in moderation, and we're omnivores, and we can have something of each. How did you decide? What was the evidence that led you to say, no, it's this stark? We're either predominantly one or the other.
All right, that's a great question. It actually, I had originally thought to call the book The Omnivore Myth, but on advice from some other reviewers, I decided to change the name. But that name that I originally came up with came to me because I believe this whole issue is based on what I call the omnivore myth. So the omnivore myth, to me, is the base belief in it is that there can be an animal that is optimally adapted to eating both plant and animal food, and that there is such an animal in existence, and that would be humans. Or there are multiple animals in existence. So what I found when I started looking for evidence that there is such a thing as an evolutionarily adapted omnivore is that there aren't any. All the omnivores we have evidence of in existence fall into one of two classes. They're either predominantly animal eaters, like wolves. They're highly adapted to eating animals. But when they're forced to, or due to circumstances, they'll eat some plants. On the other hand, we have the type of animal that's highly adapted to eating plants, but when, again, circumstances make it necessary or opportunity arises, that animal will eat some animal matter. And so a portion of one chapter of the book is list, you know, I have a table you saw lists all of the commonly cited omnivores. I went through the scientific literature, and I tried to find every kind of animal that was called an omnivore. And they're called omnivores because what? Because they can be observed sometimes eating animals, sometimes eating plants. So it's a label omnivore is applied based on behavior. And so I was looking for, is there some kind of physiology that scientists are using to identify something as an omnivore? And I couldn't find it. to my knowledge, at this point in time, there's no distinguishing feature that labels or that enables biologists to classify an animal. I'm talking about anatomical or physiological feature that leads to biologists labeling an animal an omnivore. It's based on behavior.
I want to unpack that a little bit, because to someone just listening without the background of the book, it might not make total sense. Like, why couldn't somebody, you know, there's sprinters and long distance runners, and then there's people in the middle. That there's in a lot of ways there are continua, but you make a point that is so obvious that I had to laugh. The point is basically, plants and animals are different from each other.
Yep.
Really different from each other. And so someone who is adapted to eat one is naturally, inevitably going to be ill-adapted to eat the other. Can you talk about, like, when did that occur to you? Because it's such an obvious thing that no one would ever think of it. And what are those differences? Can you just sort of lay them out?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, how did that occur to me? Well, this is actually largely a result of my experience with macrobiotics and with macrobiotic way of eating, and with I'm a licensed practitioner of Chinese medicine, so I have a master's degree in Oriental medicine. So we use the theory of yin and yang, or the classification method of yin and yang, to distinguish complementary but opposite types of phenomena. It just came to me very clearly as I was looking into this omnivore thing and so forth, that of course this distinction arises simply because plants and animals are so distinct. So plants, for example, are stationary. Animals move around. Plants are relatively silent. They don't bark. They don't make any particular kinds of noises, whereas animals make all kinds of squeaks and so forth. And when they move around, they are moving the brush around them and so forth, so they make a lot of noise. And animals have strong odors due to their physiology, and plants, you know, not so much, except in their flowers. Plants are composed primarily of carbohydrate with very little protein and fat, relatively speaking, and animals are composed primarily of protein and fat with practically no carbohydrate. And what colors? Plants are, you know, predominantly green, but they have, you know, very bright flowers and fruits that are require to be detected. They require color vision, and animals are mostly camouflage colored. They're colored so that they blend into their surroundings. So they're colored in order essentially to be invisible. So for some animal that's hunting, a vision isn't particularly important because the animal might not be particularly visible, but the odor and the sounds that animal are making are going to be your way of tracking that animal. Whereas for a animal that eats plants, detecting colors could be very, very important because the fruit may not be ripe, the fruit may be poisonous, the flowers are an indicator of the coming of fruits. All those things are signs that food is going to be available. And vision is a way to detect those because, as I stated, the odor and the sounds that it makes are practically nil. So because of these very distinct differences between plants and animals, an animal that's highly adapted to getting, succeeding at hunting for a living is going to be their senses are going to be highly tuned to detecting animals, and the senses of a plant eater are going to be highly tuned to detecting the types of plants that that animal needs to survive. And going back to the difference between the plants and animals quickly again, I mentioned that plants are high in carbohydrate and relatively low in protein and fat. So their distinguishing flavor is what carbohydrates, it's sweet. And the distinguishing flavor of meat is going to come from the proteins and fats. So an animal that's highly adapted to eating plants is going to have a strong sense of pleasure and seeking for sweets, and an animal that's highly adapted to eating meats will have a very strong sense of pleasure from eating protein and fat in its native state without any condiments or anything like that or cooking.
Right. So one of the things that I loved was just you point to the fact that you know, tastes like chicken is a catchphrase for how humans basically think all types of meat taste like chicken. It would be like a lion, you know, having a pear and going, oh, it tastes like apple.
Exactly. You're right. Exactly. Just turn it around and think, just try to imagine being in another world in which all plants basically taste the same to you. That's the world of a carnivore, because they practically, as I point out in the book, they have so few taste receptors, they can't distinguish the types of flavors that we can. Whereas, as you pointed out, for us, that's the catchphrase that people come up with. Everything tastes like chicken. Well, why? Because we can't really taste meat. We can get a sense of the fat that's in it and so forth, but it's all studies really point to, if you take meat in its native state, it's just kind of bland to humans, which is why we have ketchup and mustard and, you know, all of that stuff. Right? On the other hand, if you're a carnivore, if you see carnage, then you say, well, that's food, right? So you go for that. You enjoy seeing that because it means that food's on the way and you're going to have nourishment so that you can reproduce and sustain your family and so forth. So those signals that we get from nature, from our senses, are guiding us constantly towards what's the best thing for us to eat so that we can sustain the best of health, so that in the evolutionary idea, we can have the best reproductive chances and then pass on our genetic heritage.
Oh, I never thought of that, a flower, when we give flowers to someone, it's kind of a promise of future care.
Yeah, exactly. We see that as that portends the future for us. If we're any animal that's adapted to living off fruits of any sort, which I talk about botanical fruits, anything that's a fruit of a plant, which doesn't mean just fleshy, sweet fruits. It's all grains, seeds, legumes, nuts, all of these are botanical fruits of plants. All of those are portended. Our first knowledge that they're coming is there's a flower. So the flower is a signal that nourishment is on the way. And my contention in the book is that it's this hooking up this knowledge, or developing this knowledge, that led in large part to our cognitive evolution, that through the knowledge of plants, of how plants have a life cycle and what are the signals of food coming, that we developed our first medicine, we developed the rudiments of agriculture and so forth, and then our civilization, flowed from that whole understanding of the life cycle of plants.
Mm. So another point that you make that I've never seen articulated this way anywhere else is the idea of scarcity versus excess, that every organism has to adapt to either scarcity of a particular nutrient or excess. Could you explain that concept and how it plays into this construct?
Absolutely. So this is visible throughout all biological life. Every organism is embedded in a particular environment, and that environment will either most environments have either a scarcity or an excess of some nutrient or element that particular plant need or organism requires to thrive. So initially in the book, I used the example of different types of plants. So you have like desert adapted plants, and you have the opposite extreme, plants that live in water. So desert adapted plants have a scarcity of water. They, just like the water adapted plants, like a lily, I use the example, and a cactus. Well, the cactus needs water, but the environment it's in has a scarcity of water. So what does the cactus do? It's paradoxical. The cactus becomes very succulent in a desert environment. Why? Because its environment favors, naturally selects for those individuals that can retain fluids. So drought-adapted plants are succulents, whereas you look at the lily that lives in water, it's got a superabundance of water. It's got more water than it can need, than it can use. So what does it have to do? It has to come up with some kind of mechanism to prevent from getting waterlogged. And, you know, people who take care of plants know this. If you give too much water to a succulent plant, it'll kill it. And if you give, because it will take up too much water, and then it will rot. And on the converse, if you don't give enough water to the lily, it's not immersed in enough water, it will die because it doesn't get enough. So its water requirement is higher because it's adapted to a highly liquid environment. So the same applies to animals. Animals that have a diet that's super abundant in protein, for example, have mechanisms for detoxifying and getting rid of the excess amino acids. They're highly, and because of that, they have an extraordinarily high requirement for amino acids. The example of a cat. Cats, they have to get if I remember correctly, it's about 25% of their calories as a minimum as protein, because if you give them less than that, they won't meet their basic amino acid requirements, because they have an automatic system that turns a large part of the protein they consume into glucose. Whereas an animal that is adapted to a low protein diet has mechanisms for conserving amino acids and recycling, so it can will thrive on a lower protein intake, and because of its highly conservative use of protein in excess becomes a toxin to that type of highly protein conservative organism.
So this is a very elegant evolutionary solution, that every organism is evolved for getting rid of stuff that is in abundance, right? So it uses what it needs and is very good at getting rid of the rest. And the things that are scarce, it's very good at hoarding. And
exactly.
So if you flip that around, if you create sort of an evolutionary mismatch and you suddenly put the water lily in the desert or the cactus in a pond, or put the human in an environment where all of a sudden animal protein is easily accessible, you're going to cause problems.
Exactly, because now the environment works against the mechanisms. The mechanisms are mismatched to the environment now, and where, as in the original environment, for example, the lily had to keep getting rid of water, now it's put in the desert. If it keeps getting rid of water there, what happens? Death. Same thing for the cactus. When it was in the desert, it had to keep getting rid of water, and it became highly adapted to doing that. Put it in the water. Now holding on to water. Now you put it in the water, it starts holding on to all of that water. It becomes waterlogged, and then it also dies. So the same thing for any type of animal. If the animal is adapted to a diet that's high in carbohydrate, for example, we have mechanisms for burning off excess carbohydrate. That's called dietary thermogenesis. There's a limit to that. It's not like you can eat carbohydrate till the cows come home and you'll never get an adverse effect, but there's a buffer. We have a system that buffers against excess carbohydrate consumption. So if we have a low carbohydrate environment, then we can start to have negative effects, which are recorded in so many studies on low carbohydrate diets, where people get constipation and they get moody and they get all kinds of side effects that they don't like because their body is adapted to processing a large amount of carbohydrate. That's from the native environment. Now they're being asked to adapt to an environment that's opposite to what the body's metabolism is adapted.
Right. And unlike a water lily or a cactus, it could take decades for humans to really see the clinical results of a mismatched diet.
Yeah, this is an example I use early in the book. Is lipid metabolism. So if an animal is adapted to a diet that's high in fat and cholesterol, as an example, dogs or cats, they have mechanisms for reducing their cholesterol production, endogenous cholesterol production. It can go to zero in dogs. So they're just relying on the cholesterol in their diet. And then they have other mechanisms for dealing with the potentially deleterious effects of having excesses of fat and cholesterol coming into the system. Where humans lack those mechanisms, so it doesn't kill you right away to eat a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, but over time, that stuff accumulates and it starts to plug up, various channels in the body. We have it feeds the process that leads to atherosclerosis and that's a type of long-term effect. So you don't notice the effects right away, but 20 years down the road, because we're a long-lived species, the effects of that, if it's sustained over time, start to show up.
Right. So there's a lot more that we could go into here, but I'd love to shift to the hunting myth. And here's how I heard it. The story that made sense to me when I didn't have more information. So human beings are persistence hunters. We can sweat, so that means that we're the fastest animal over dozens and hundreds of miles. So we can outrun the rest of them. Born to run. Running made us human. Because we now could chase those animals down. the when we learned to harness fire, we could cook them. That caused our brains to grow. We had to develop language so that we could communicate with other hunters because we lacked the speed and talons and claws to bring the animals down without them. That basically hunting made us human, and that we are, you know, we have binocular vision like predators as opposed to you know, deer and birds that are prey animals. So that's a good story, and it makes it in its own context, it makes a lot of sense. What's the rebuttal to that story?
Well, yeah, it's what you call a just so story. So first thing that I want to respond to is the idea of, well, we have binocular vision like predators, right? So what's happened there is that there's just a jump, right? We completely forget that every other primate also has binocular vision, and they're plant eaters. So binocular vision is an example of what we call convergent evolution. In other words, cats and dogs have binocular vision because it assists them with hunting. Primates have binocular vision because it assists them with going from limb to limb in trees, looking for fruits. So binocular vision evolved in these two different lineages for different reasons. So then leaping from the fact that now we have binocular vision and so do dogs, therefore we must have by nature be adapted to a diet like dogs is a non sequitur, right? It's like completely dropping out this background lineage and the reason why we have, and without recognizing that the reason that we have binocular vision is different from the reason why dogs have binocular vision. So what else is wrong with that story? Well, a lot of things I cover in the book. So we don't have, we have over a distance of 100 miles or whatever, a greater speed than some other animals. There are several problems with that story. Well, let's take a look at the environment in which this was supposed to evolve. So humans are a very water-hungry species. According to this story, we evolved in basically a desert. So we're chasing down animals, sweating like mad, without any water stations. We're not doing the Boston Marathon now. We're not talking about an assisted long-distance marathon race where there's a car following behind giving you water and there's water stations and you go along. We're talking about running across the open desert chasing down a kuru. What's the problem with that? If we're sweating like this, running across the desert, we get dehydrated, we get overheated, we get hypothermia. We still get hypothermia even though we have all this assistance during marathon races. It doesn't fit with our current understanding of the water requirements and the susceptibility to hypothermia that we have in modern assisted circumstances. What's another problem with that? When we look at hunter-gatherers that are known to engage in persistence hunting, their return rate is very low. We're talking about maybe by persistence hunting, they get one successful hunt per month. That's according to the research cited in my book. So you can't live on you can't feed a family, can't feed a tribe on one carcass per month. And in addition, you just, as I go through all the numbers in the book, the success rate is so low that we have to imagine that our persistence hunting ancestors were doing several persistence hunts per week basically on an empty stomach. So they're all running 20-mile marathons two or three times a week on an empty stomach, hoping that eventually they're going to get that one successful hunt.
So this is the play the lottery style of financial planning.
Exactly.
Right. You have no money, so every week you have to play the lottery in the hopes of, like, not only is it stupid, it's not even possible.
Right. Right. Exactly. So it's not even possible.
Is that kind of the punchline of Powered by Plants? Is that the only way that someone or that a group of men could engage in persistence hunting is if they didn't need to, if they already were powered by the carbohydrates in plants?
Exactly. That's the punchline. If they, we know from studies of those hunter-gatherers that when do they do this persistence hunting? They do it when the plant foods are flush. They got plenty of plant foods. They don't have to help the women go gather anymore. It's time to do a little sporting activity. Let's go hunt down some kuru. We have plenty of food in our stomachs. Now we can engage in a riskier activity for the hope of that extra luxury food.
Right.
And that's what we see happening, you know, as I provide the evidence in the book also. That's what we see happening in chimpanzees as well. They hunt when they have plenty of fruit available. When they don't have plenty of fruit available, man, they're looking for plants.
Right. So one of the things you say is that, you know, hunt men who are hunters by temperament or by physiology, or you know, obviously we're not ever going to be a hunter like a tiger, but who are sort of closer, better able to hunt, were selected not by natural selection because they were bringing home the bacon, but because it was sexier, that men somehow convinced women that a hunter was a better mate. How the hell did that happen?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, I just suggest that as a hypothesis, because if you look at the reality of it economically, humans, because of our physiology, couldn't actually afford to invest, except in extreme environments like the circumpolar environments. They couldn't really afford to invest in hunting as a subsistence strategy initially in our earliest stages of evolution, without a background of having a high capability of securing plenty of food from plants. So then what happens? Well, I'm only offering this as a potential hypothesis, and that is that just like in modern circumstances where winners of sporting events are sort of idolized, they become the magnets for attention from both men and women. They become, you know, potential leaders, that those who were able to bring home the bison, in other words, the extra buck, the extra food, the luxury food, were seen as the best or best potential providers. So therefore they attracted more female attention and they became selected in that way. So they had a greater, more opportunities for reproduction because the early human women looked at them and said, hey, that guy not only can bring home plants, but he can also bring home that animal. So I'm going to go have some, you know, we'll have children with him, and then my children will be more like powerful and, you know, capable like him, and so then the genes get passed on. But along this whole time, all of the species is still dependent on plants as the what's called in anthropology the fallback food, because the animals aren't always there. Due to migration and due to starvation and so forth, the animals can be very lean, and that bison he brings home isn't always bacon-like. It's often very stringy and partially inedible, or oftentimes rejected by hunter-gatherers because they're so lean. So you still have to fall back on eating the potatoes and sweet potatoes or the foods like those.
Well, it's almost like, you know, in a divorced couple with kids where the, you know, the dad is like the favorite parent because he just takes them out to movies and McDonald's and Disneyland while the mom is doing all the fallback feeding and nurturing.
Exactly. That, I mean, that's when in the book I discussed one anthropologist's observation about the San people. They go hunting. They sometimes do persistence hunting. And they also go hunting with bow and arrow. Well, these people are capable of producing a high-powered bow that actually could kill an animal. And they have poison they put on the tips, right? Mm-hmm. So they could easily have a bow and arrow that would actually bring home the wild boar more often. But as a matter of fact, they have these wimpy little bows and they shoot these very little arrows with a little bit of poison on it. And then they do the persistence after they wounded it, then they do the persistence hunting. And the person who observed this said, it's like, that's a sporting event. That's not, there's all these handicaps. This is not for subsistence. This is just playtime for the men. Which of course it would be. They got plenty of food. The women brought home all of the food and sustenance and they're taking care of the kids. Now the guys go out and say, hey, let's go hunt down some kuru here. I've got this wimpy little bow. We've got some little poison. We can go run for a few hours and come back. And the women will have plenty of food when we get back, even if we don't bring anything home. So, hey, we're good.
And yet it's, you know, hunting and meat is such an important part of the culture, it seems to me. Like if you, and I think maybe that's one of the big cultural blowbacks against veganism, is it's almost like you're cutting off somebody's testicles, that you're saying, you know, that manliness isn't important anymore.
Right. Yeah. And I think it may go back to this very phenomenon where this one thing that men seem to be particularly good at it relative to women, because of, you know, the physiology, the difference in physiology that men have, the testosterone levels, et cetera, the greater propensity to risk taking and that kind of thing that comes from having higher testosterone than women, that enables man to be more successful at something that's a higher risk activity like hunting. And so somehow it gets installed in the collective psyche that now you're saying that this whole, that men aren't necessary, you know, being a man isn't necessary. So, whereas if you're saying meat is important, and I think that's a big part of the draw, as you said earlier, you hinted at earlier, of the paleo movement and the low carb movement, is that now men are necessary because we have to bring home that meat. That the women, you know, they're not that good at bringing home the meat, and plus they don't know how to grill it right and all of that. So we can do that and really put, you know, contribute to the evolution of our species. It's kind of putting men on the back burner, or at least on a equal footing with women, and that kind of, you know, doesn't feel good to some people of the male persuasion.
Right. It's like, this is all I've got. You know, this is my only trick.
Right. That's right. That's right.
So I see we're at about an hour. And I just want to maybe look back. We have touched literally 1% of the parts that I've read. There is so much here. It's, you know, at a certain point, at like 10% of the book done, I suddenly got the feeling like I was reading a book trying to prove to me that the sky was blue. I was like, well, this is so obvious.
I know. That's what I felt like. As I was accumulating information, I was like, after I got past this one point, I mean, I was like, everything just fell into my lap. I was like, how can it be that nobody sees this? Or very few people see this. How can it be that I even have to argue this? It just seems weird.
Right. So given what we've discussed so far, and that it's a tiny percentage of a very, very elaborate and well-referenced argument, is there anything, if someone sends this to their paleo friend and they've listened so far, are there a couple of like obvious objections that someone's going to still make that we haven't talked about that maybe we can round out by covering?
Couple of obvious
objections. Like if someone says, vegans don't get enough B12, or they don't get iron or D. Someone who's listened this far, what do they still have in their holster?
Right. So I tried to cover all of those because I'd been in the paleo community for so long, about 12 years. I knew all the arguments that are used to try to, you know, make it sound like eating meat is so essential to our evolution and our sustenance and our future health. So I covered the fatty acid thing and the B12 and all of that. So like B12 is often the holdout, but then the omega-3 fatty acids has now become the latest thing, which I covered extensively in the book. So B12, of course, you know, my main response to that is that B12 is not an animal product. B12 is a microbial product. In the ancient environment, even only a couple hundred years ago, the B12 availability in the environment was dramatically higher than it is today because we weren't using chlorinated water. Essentially, it comes down to that. Chlorinated water and all of our modern hygiene just basically eliminates a large part of the exposure to B12 producing microbes that we would normally have or that we would have in a natural circumstance. And then the omega-3 thing, I think, is the other argument that is most commonly, grabbed onto by advocates of meat eating. The whole idea is that we need to eat animal foods because we can't produce enough DHA to build a brain without eating meat. And that's a whole big part of the argument that meat made us human, is that there was this particular nutrient in meat, and one by one, we've shown that that hasn't been the case, that there is, you know, we could get iron, we could get this, we could get that. And then what came up next is the DHA. So the DHA is now the holdout. So I spent quite a bit of ink in the book going through the research that basically shows that we don't need dietary DHA. And it's, to me, of interest that it's even a question among people who are eating plant-based diets. I mean, the plant-based vegan dietitians and so forth who are still questioning whether we need to have dietary DHA. Some are suggesting that just to hedge our bets, we better take some algae-based DHA and so forth. And you'll have to read the book to get the full story, but there's like the summary is that there have been people building brains all over the planet and still are, who aren't getting DHA on a daily basis and aren't regularly consuming grass-fed animal products or fish, and they still build normal human brains on plant-based diets. It's sitting right in front of us, just like most of everything else I said in the book. It's right there. Large groups of Seventh-day Adventists and Buddhists and Taoists and Jains and Hindus and blah, blah, there's a big list. Large populations of people in China and so forth who are essentially getting no dietary DHA or so little it's inconsequential. It's an example. The DHA issue is a very good example. Excuse me. I need water. It's a very good example of the scarcity versus conservation, a scarcity and with conservation, or abundance with profligate expenditure adaptation. So GHA is indeed scarce in a plant-based diet, scarce to non-existent. However, the people who most matter in this regard, women, are very capable of like 200 times more efficient than males at converting plant-based omega-3 into DHA. And not only that, they don't have to get it on demand during the baby's gestation or lactation. They do it every single day of their lives under the influence of estrogen. They store it up in their hips, in their gluteal fat, in their thigh fat, so that it's available there at all times. Anytime there's a pregnancy, anytime there's a need for lactation, it's there. They have evolution, if you want to say, produced a very elegant response of DHA storage in the curvy features of women for future demand.
So that explains why Kim Kardashian is on the cover of so many magazines.
Exactly. Right. From an evolutionary psychology standpoint, is that that curvy figure of a woman indicates that she has a large store of essential fatty acids for bringing children to full fruition.
I'm glad I didn't learn about evolutionary biology until I got married. I think I would have been a very bad dating partner had I known this stuff.
Right. I don't know if it came across in the book, but I'm not a believer nor a non-believer in evolution by natural selection. I think there are very reasonable arguments against large portions of the evolution by natural selection theory of human emergence. Nevertheless, my point in the book is, if you take that perspective, which all the paleo people do, using your own argument, your paleo diet falls on its face.
Great. Well, that's an intriguing way to end. I feel like if I follow that statement, that there's other ways to look at our current existence other than being explained by natural selection. But I think I want to leave that for now. I will say that the arguments in the book, there's so many great examples. And one of the things I love about the way you write is that I can remember whole lines of argument through just a single example, like the water lilies and the cactus. You have a great story about pandas. You have a great story about rhesus monkeys and cholesterol, and they all illustrate these points that are so important when we're trying to figure out what our optimal diet is. So the book is Powered by Plants by Don Matez. And if people want to follow you and follow your work and see what you're up to and keep reading your latest, how can they stay in touch?
Well, you can... I got a lot of stuff on the net. So I've got my blog, donmatez.blogspot.com, or you can just Google Vital Wisdom, V-I-T-A-L, Wisdom. Then we have a YouTube channel called Plant-Based Solution. And we also have a website called plantbasedsolution.com. And we have a blog called, okay, so one's plantbasedsolution.com and the other one's theplantbasedsolution.com.
Okay. I'll put, yeah. For folks who are just listening auditorily, if you go to plantyourself.com, I'll have links to all that. So you don't have to write it down. You can just go and click.
Yeah, that's good. And then, of course, I'm on Facebook. with my name, and then we have the Plant Based Solution Facebook page and Plant Based Solution Health Group on Facebook.
Great. So for people who it sounds like you have a solution. Like, what are the services or products that you offer people?
Well, we besides my book, Tracy's got the book Make Every Bite Count, which is a vegan cookbook, and we provide nutrition consultation, private nutrition consultation by Skype or telephone or whatever works, email. We have ebooks coming out. We have a bunch of information products available and online to be released in the future. More than 333 videos on our Plant-Based Solution channel, which have recipes, nutrition information. Some of the videos I put on there are like Michael Greger's, so they're covering specific topics like does soy cause thyroid suppression, was a recent one, or what's the ideal fat percentage of a diet, and blah blah blah, those kinds of things. You can just look up those. And what else do we have? We got the ebooks. So yeah, we have other ebooks available right now. One's called The True Garden of Eating, which is kind of a cookbook and how to transition to a plant-based diet.
Great. Well, so it sounds like there's a lot of resources, both for people who are firmly in the plant-based camp, who are looking to get new recipes, new ways of cooking, for people who are looking to help others transition, and for your biggest market is the soon-to-be disaffected paleo adherents who wake up one day when their health is compromised and all the things they did out of the best of intentions to eat the perfect human diet turn out to be wrong and harmful. And so I think you have a great roadmap for those folks back to sanity and then back to health.
Yep, that's our goal, is to help people, even if we can get people to eat, just cut down their animal product to 10% or less of the diet. It would make a huge difference for their health as well as for the ecological impact of the human race on the planet. So ideally, we like to see people go totally 100% plant-based. That's what we do. That's what we recommend. But we cheer every reduction in animal products that people can make.
Right on. Well, Don Matez, thank you so much. This has been eye-opening. I'm going to keep reading the book, because there's more, every page has more eye-opening information for me, and I'm pretty well informed on this stuff. So you've both unearthed research that is very far in, you know, out of left field in terms of the normal things we read. You know, you've got general semantics theory from Korzybski. You've got Stanley Coren on humans versus dogs. So there's a lot of things that are just new to me, and the way you put it together, even things that I knew, like the significance of taking aspirin for anticoagulation, all those things create a very vivid and compelling picture. And I recommend this book to anyone who is confused about what is the optimal human diet.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We're not strong at marketing. We're good at production of information products. So anything that anyone can do to help us get the word out, we're really happy for.
Right. Well, it's high quality thought and high quality stuff. So people listening, definitely check this out. It's life changing.
All right, thanks.
Thank you so much, Don. Be well.
And you too. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Don Matez. Your action step, should you choose to take one, is to get his book, Powered by Plants, and read it. For extra credit, you might pick up one of the paleo books, either Neanderthin by Ray Audette, the book that first got him into the movement, or any of the books by Cordain or Gary Taubes, and really compare them side by side, and see which tells a compelling story and which actually has scientific evidence behind it. I generally don't recommend books by Taubes and the other low-carb folks. But in this case, when you put them next to each other, it's a real education in evidence-based versus fantasy-based science writing. If you like the podcast and you'd like to help us grow, one of the best things you can do is go to iTunes and leave a review. You can also share links on social media, tell friends about it, get a tattoo. You can donate a little money to help defray all my costs. Down at the bottom right of plantyourself.com, there's a little donate button. You can put in whatever you like. The garden is slowing down these days. Most of the harvest is over except for the basil. So I've got a lot of work to do to figure out why the soil didn't support as much as we thought and get it ready for a fall planting. If you're in the Triangle region of North Carolina, I've got some events coming up. I've got a dessert making class from 1 to 3 p.m. on August 15th. That's a Saturday. I've got a 4-hour How to Get Started class on September 5th, also a Saturday, for people who are new to the whole food plant-based diet and want a head start and some tricks and skills for transitioning. I've also got a couple of intro dinners in Hillsboro, North Carolina. Those are absolutely free. All you need to do is go online and RSVP, and you can find all that at plantyourself.com. In other news, the book Proteinaholic that Dr. Garth Davis and I worked on for most of this year is coming out in October. If you go to proteinaholic.com, you can pre-order, you can start reading about it. The website's a work in progress, but me saying this in public will light a fire under my butt to get more done on it, so that's why I did that. So I hope whatever's lighting a fire under your butt is fun and motivating and pushing you in great directions, and as always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.